Chapter 16. Principle 2: Go behind which we must enter the kingdom of metaphysics. Kepler guessed that is to say imagined. He was essentially a theorist, that word now of so much sanctity, formerly an epithet of contempt. Would it not have puzzled these old moles to have explained by which of the two odes a cryptographist unriddles a cryptograph of more than usual secrecy, or by which of the two roads Champollion directed mankind to those enduring and almost innumerable truths which resulted from his deciphering the hieroglyphics? One word more on this topic and I will be done boring you. Is it not passing strange that, with their eternal prattling about roads to truth, these bigoted people missed what we now so clearly perceive to be the great highway, that of consistency? Does it not seem singular how they should have failed to deduce from the works of God the vital fact that a perfect consistency must be an absolute truth? How plain has been our progress since the late announcement of this proposition? Investigation has been taken out of the hands of the ground moles and given, as a task, to the true, and only true thinkers, the men of ardent imagination. These latter theorize. Can you not fancy the shout of scorn with which my words would be received by our progenitors, were it possible for them to be now looking over my shoulder? These men, I say, theorize, and their theories are simply corrected, reduced, systematized, cleared, little by little, of their dross of inconsistency until, finally, a perfect consistency stands apparent which even the most stolid admit, because it is a consistency, to be an absolute and an unquestionable truth. April 4. The new gas is doing wonders, in conjunction with the new improvement with gutta percha. How very safe, commodious, manageable, and in every respect convenient are our modern balloons. Here is an immense one approaching us at the rate of at least 150 miles an hour. It seems to be crowded with people, perhaps there are 300 or 400 passengers, and yet it soars to an elevation of nearly a mile, looking down upon poor us with sovereign contempt. Still 100, or even 200 miles an hour is slow traveling after all. Do you remember our flight on the railroad across the Canada continent? Fully 300 miles the hour that was traveling. Nothing to be seen, though nothing to be done but flirt, feast, and dance in the magnificent saloons. Do you remember what an odd sensation was experienced when, by chance, we caught a glimpse of external objects while the cars were in full flight? Everything seemed unique in one mass. For my part, I cannot say but that I preferred the traveling by the slow train of 100 miles the hour. Here we were permitted to have glass windows, even to have them open, and something like a distinct view of the country was attainable. Pundit says that the route for the Great Canada Railroad must have been in some measure marked out about 900 years ago. In fact, he goes so far as to assert that actual traces of a road are still discernible, traces referable to a period quite as remote as that mentioned. The track, it appears, was double only ours, you know, has 12 paths, and 3 or 4 new ones are in preparation. The ancient rails were very slight, and placed so close together as to be, according to modern notions, quite frivolous, if not dangerous in the extreme. The present width of track 50 feet is considered, indeed, scarcely secure enough. For my part, I make no doubt that a track of some sort must have existed in very remote times, as Pundit asserts. For nothing can be clearer, to my mind, than that, at some period not less than 7 centuries ago, certainly the northern and southern Canada continents were united. The Canadians, then, would have been driven, by necessity, to a great railroad across the continent. April 5. I am almost devoured by ennui. Pundit is the only conversable person on board, and he, poor soul, can speak of nothing but antiquities. He has been occupied all the day in the attempt to convince me that the ancient Americans governed themselves. Did ever anybody hear of such an absurdity? that they existed in a sort of every man for himself confederacy, after the fashion of the prairie dogs that we read of in fable. He says that they started with the queerest idea conceivable, viz. That all men are born free, and equal. This in the very teeth of the laws of gradation so visibly impressed upon all things both in the moral and physical universe. Every man oded, as they called it, that is to say meddled with public affairs, until at length it was discovered that what is everybody's business is nobody's, and that the republic, so the absurd thing was called, was without a government at all. It is related, however, that the first circumstance which disturbed, very particularly, the self-complacency of the philosophers who constructed this republic, was the startling discovery that universal suffrage gave opportunity for fraudulent schemes, by means of which any desired number of votes might at any time be polled, without the possibility of prevention or even detection, by any party which should be merely villainous enough not to be ashamed of the fraud. A little reflection upon this discovery sufficed to render evident the consequences, which were that rascality must predominate. In a word, that a republican government could never be anything but a rascally one. While the philosophers, however, were busied in blushing at their stupidity in not having foreseen these inevitable evils, and intent upon the invention of new theories, the matter was put to an abrupt issue by a fellow of the name of Mob, who took everything into his own hands and set up a despotism, in comparison with which those of the fabulous Zeros and Hilophagabaluses were respectable and delectable. This Mob, a foreigner, by the by, is said to have been the most odious of all men that ever encumbered the earth. He was a giant in stature, insolent, rapacious, filthy, had the gall of a bullock with the heart of a hyena, and the brains of a peacock. He died, at length, by dint of his own energies, which exhausted him. Nevertheless, he had his uses, as everything has, however vile, and taught mankind a lesson which to this day it is in no danger of forgetting, never to run directly contrary to the natural analogies. As for republicanism, no analogy could be found for it upon the face of the earth, unless we accept the case of the prairie dogs, an exception which seems to demonstrate, if anything, that democracy is a very admirable form of government for dogs. April 6. Last night had a fine view of Alpha Lyrae, whose disk, through our captain's spy glass, subtends an angle of half a degree, looking very much as our sun does to the naked eye on a misty day. Alpha Lyrae, although so very much larger than our sun, by the by, resembles him closely as regards its spots, its atmosphere, and in many other particulars. It is only within the last century, pundit tells me, that the binary relation existing between these two orbs began even to be suspected. The evident motion of our system in the heavens was, strange to say, referred to an orbit about a prodigious star in the center of the galaxy. About this star, or at all events about a center of gravity common to all the globes of the Milky Way and supposed to be near Alcyon in the Pleiades, every one of these globes was declared to be revolving, our own performing the circuit in a period of 117 million of years. We, with our present lights, our vast telescopic improvements, and so forth, of course find it difficult to comprehend the ground of an idea such as this. Its first propagator was one Mutiler. He was led, we must presume, to this wild hypothesis by mere analogy in the first instance. But, this being the case, he should have at least adhered to analogy in its development. A great central orb was, in fact, suggested. So far Mutiler was consistent. This central orb, however, dynamically, should have been greater than all its surrounding orbs taken together. The question might then have been asked, why do we not see it? We, especially, who occupy the mid-region of the cluster, the very locality near which, at least, must be situated this inconceivable central sun. The astronomer, perhaps, at this point, took refuge in the suggestion of non-luminosity, and here analogy was suddenly let fall. But even admitting the central orb non-luminous, how did he manage to explain its failure to be rendered visible by the incalculable host of glorious suns glaring in all directions about it? No doubt what he finally maintained was merely a center of gravity common to all the revolving orbs, but here again analogy must have been let fall. Our system revolves, it is true, about a common center of gravity, but it does this in connection with, and in consequence of, a material sun whose mass more than counterbalances the rest of the system. The mathematical circle is a curve composed of an infinity of straight lines, but this idea of the circle, this idea of it which, in regard to all earthly geometry, we consider as merely the mathematical, in contradistinction from the practical, idea is, in sober fact, the practical conception which alone we have any right to entertain in respect to those titanic circles with which we have to deal, at least in fancy, when we suppose our system, with its fellows, revolving about a point in the center of the galaxy. Let the most vigorous of human imaginations but attempt to take a single step toward the comprehension of a circuit so unutterable. I would scarcely be paradoxical to say that a flash of lightning itself, traveling forever upon the circumference of this inconceivable circle, would still forever be traveling in a straight line. That the path of our sun along such a circumference, that the direction of our system in such an orbit would, to any human perception, deviate in the slightest degree from a straight line even in a million of years, is a proposition not to be entertained. And yet these ancient astronomers were absolutely cajoled, it appears, into believing that a decisive curvature had become apparent during the brief period of their astronomical history during the mere point during the utter nothingness of 2,000 or 3,000 years. How incomprehensible that considerations such as this did not at once indicate to them the true state of affairs, that of the binary revolution of our sun, and Alpha Lyrae around a common center of gravity. April 7. Continued last night our astronomical amusements. Had a fine view of the 5 Neptunian asteroids, and watched with much interest the putting up of a huge impost on a couple of lintels in the new temple at Daphnis in the moon. It was amusing to think that creatures so diminutive as the Lunarians, and bearing so little resemblance to humanity, yet evinced a mechanical ingenuity so much superior to our own. One finds it difficult to conceive the vast masses which these people handle so easily, to be as light as our own reason tells us they actually are. April 8. Eureka! Pundit is in his glory. A balloon from Canada spoke us today, and threw on board several late papers. They contain some exceedingly curious information relative to Canadian or rather American antiquities. You know, I presume, that laborers have for some months been employed in preparing the ground for a new fountain at Paradise, the Emperor's principal pleasure garden. Paradise, it appears, has been, literally speaking, an island time out of mind, that is to say, its northern boundary was always, as far back as any record extends, a rivulet, or rather a very narrow arm of the sea. This arm was gradually widened until it attained its present breadth a mile. The whole length of the island is 9 miles. The breadth varies materially. The entire area, so Pundit says, was, about 800 years ago, densely packed with houses, some of them 20 stories high. Land, for some most unaccountable reason, being considered as especially precious just in this vicinity. The disastrous earthquake, however, of the year 2050 so totally uprooted and overwhelmed the town, for it was almost too large to be called a village, that the most indefatigable of our antiquarians have never yet been able to obtain from the site any sufficient data in the shape of coins, medals or inscriptions, wherewith to build up even the ghost of a theory concerning the manners, customs, and sea, of the aboriginal inhabitants. Nearly all that we have hitherto known of them is, that they were a portion of the Knickerbocker tribe of savages infesting the continent at its first discovery by recorder Riker, a knight of the Golden Fleece. They were by no means uncivilized, however, but cultivated various arts, and even sciences after a fashion of their own. It is related of them that they were acute in many respects, but were oddly afflicted with monomania for building what, in the ancient American, was denominated churches, a kind of pagoda instituted for the worship of two idols that went by the names of wealth and fashion. In the end, it is said, the island became, 9/10 of it, church. The women too, it appears, were oddly deformed by a natural protuberance of the region just below the small of the back, although, most unaccountably, this deformity was looked upon altogether in the light of a beauty. One or two pictures of these singular women have in fact, been miraculously preserved. They look very odd, very like something between a turkey cock and a dromedary. Well, these few details are nearly all that have descended to us respecting the ancient Knickerbockers. It seems, however, that while digging in the center of the emperor's garden, which, you know, covers the whole island, some of the workmen unearthed a cubical and evidently chiseled block of granite, weighing several hundred pounds. It was in good preservation, having received, apparently, little injury from the convulsion which entombed it. On one of its surfaces was a marble slab with, only think of it, an inscription, a legible inscription. Pundit is in ecstasies. Upon detaching the slab, a cavity appeared, containing a leaden box filled with various coins, a long scroll of names, several documents which appear to resemble newspapers, with other matters of intense interest to the antiquarian. There can be no doubt that all these are genuine American relics belonging to the tribe called Knickerbocker. The papers thrown on board our balloon are filled with facsimiles of the coins, MSS. Topography, and C, and C. I copy for your amusement the Knickerbocker inscription on the marble slab. This cornerstone of a monument to the memory of George Washington was laid with appropriate ceremonies on the 19th day of October, 1847, the anniversary of the surrender of Lord Cornwallis to General Washington at Yorktown, A.D. 1781, under the auspices of the Washington Monument Association of the City of New York. This, as I give it, is a verbatim translation done by Pundit himself, so there can be no mistake about it. From the few words thus preserved, we glean several important items of knowledge, not the least interesting of which is the fact that 1,000 years ago actual monuments had fallen into disuse, as was all very proper, the people contenting themselves, as we do now, with a mere indication of the design, to erect a monument at some future time, a cornerstone being cautiously laid by itself, solitary, and alone. Excuse me for quoting the great American poet Benton. Comma, as a guarantee of the magnanimous intention, we ascertain too, very distinctly, from this admirable inscription, the how as well as the where and the what, of the great surrender in question. As to the where, it was Yorktown, wherever that was, and as to the what, it was General Cornwallis, no doubt some wealthy dealer in corn, he was surrendered. The inscription commemorates the surrender of what? Why, of Lord Cornwallis. The only question is, what could the savages wish him surrendered for? But when we remember that these savages were undoubtedly cannibals, we are led to the conclusion that they intended him for sausage. As to the how of the surrender, no language can be more explicit. Lord Cornwallis was surrendered for sausage, under the auspices of the Washington Monument Association, no doubt a charitable institution for the depositing of cornerstones. But, heaven bless me, what is the matter? Ah, I see the balloon has collapsed, and we shall have a tumble into the sea. I have, therefore, only time enough to add that, from a hasty inspection of the facsimiles of newspapers, and see, I find that the great men in those days among the Americans were one John, a smith, and one Zachary, a tailor. Goodbye, until I see you again. Whether you ever get this letter or not is point of little importance, as I write altogether for my own amusement. I shall cork the MS up in a bottle, however, and throw it into the sea. Yours everlastingly, Candida. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.